a lot of the time reading selections from plays that have been written at various periods since the Vietnam War, and some responses of things that are happening. I don't find it unusual that probably the three sessions that are meeting right now, this is the smallest. And I don't mean that in any critical nature, but I think yet, in 1989, Vietnam is one of those topics that kind of churn people up inside, and there's a lot of negative aspects to that topic that people don't want to deal with. And there's been so much over the last 20 years that has hit us about Vietnam that we have difficulty. I just want to mention before we get going further too, that if there is anyone who might be offended by some language that may be a little raw and to the point, there's not a lot of it, but the drama of the period was as inciting as the time itself. So you will not offend me if you leave. Before we go, some of you who were here the other day know that this week I'm talking in connection with Rainbow on the Mountain Week, trying to approach Vietnam as one of the aspects of theater that looks at the many worlds of theater. My general theme for the week is all the worlds of stage. And I'm taking various aspects as it's affected my life, and I've been connected with it, and as it affects theater in general, and as theater affects our society, which is one of my ongoing themes. But first of all, as I did on Monday, I'd like everybody to close their eyes for a minute. Just close their eyes. And I want you to remember the summer of 1969, 20 years ago. Place yourself in that summer of 1969. Okay, open your eyes. Let's just hear some results of where people were in 1969 and what kinds of things they were doing in 1969 or thinking about in 1969.
I had a two-year-old on the rug in the living room and I was watching the spacewalk.
Okay, somebody else.
Our family was camping in Europe listening to the radio.
Spacewalk. Anybody else?
We were here listening to the Vietnam War discussion.
Here at Holden Village in 69. Anybody else?
We were returning from Kauai after having dropped out from Berkeley, returning to the mainland.
Okay. Anybody else?
I just moved from one town to another.
Okay.
I was a freshman at the University of California after a protest in the war.
Ah. Okay. Anybody else?
I just dropped out of college and was waiting to get drafted. Don't call me around the answers.
Okay. That's my own experience, and those of you that maybe heard Jerry Swanson this morning say in 1968 I had just graduated from Augsburg College in Minneapolis, and I was classified 1A. For those of you that don't know, that means I was eligible for the draft. I had signed a teaching contract in Howard Lake, Minnesota. The school district was Howard Lake, Waverly, which was the home of Hubert Humphrey at the time. In fact, in the fall of 1968, I voted for Hubert Humphrey in the same polling place that Hubert Humphrey voted in. And so I spent the whole summer at Holden really struggling, inner struggles, spiritual struggles, emotional struggles, family struggles. My father had died the year before, and I was trying to figure out how I was going to respond. I, who shaved my beard to campaign for Gene McCarthy in the spring, and whose feeling was very much anti-war. In 1968, I started teaching in September, got drafted in September, postponed it till January, appealed it, postponed it till June. In June of 1969, 20 years ago this summer, I was in basic training at Fort Lewis, Washington. So I got to come out to Washington again. And I was there exactly this time 20 years ago. And in November of 1969, 20 years ago, I was sent to Vietnam as a combat infantryman assigned to the 1st Cavalry Air Mobile Division. It's the one with the yellow patch. The yellow patch and the little horse, as they said in the Army, it was the horse they never rode, the bridge they never crossed, and the yellow speaks for itself. That was the general phrase. And I was assigned to a reconnaissance platoon, which is of 20 guys who go out, and their job is to get shot at, so everybody else will come in and find the bad guys. As such, I obviously have very personal connections to Vietnam. For me, 20 years ago, 19 years ago, is more alive in my head than things that have happened since in my life. One Vietnam veteran colleague of mine put it this way several years ago as he was thinking about Vietnam and the American public and our inability to talk about it. If I could, I would give you Vietnam, its pain, beauty, blood, dying. If I could, I would scoop it up, put it in a bucket. I would pick it up, brimming, red and shining, and then I would throw it in your face. That's a very bitter short poem. What I'm going to do today will give you a sample of the kinds of drama that has been written about Vietnam, many by Vietnam veterans. And the plays have been written at various points. I will read plays about young Vietnam, early 60s, and attitudes of young men before they went there. I will read some comic satire pieces, because satire was one of the most important pieces, elements of drama in Vietnam. I'm going to read a selection from a play about a black Medal of Honor winner going through counseling. I'm going to read a play about women associated with veterans in Vietnam. And I'm going to read some plays, a play that was written after, during the process of Vietnam by the peace movement here. I want to read as much as I can, and I also want to give you an opportunity to respond to some of the readings, so I'm going to try to do that. And in some ways, the background will fit in, because part of what I'm dealing with is, as Scott's been talking about, journeys, and other speakers have talked about enemies. We're going to be talking about that other people, that Asian people as well, that was so easy for us to make the enemy at the time. I'm going to start by reading a play by David Rabe. And David Rabe was probably the first playwright to really gain prominence out of the Vietnam War. He wrote a number of plays, a trilogy of plays, The Basic Training of Pablo Hummel, Sticks and Bones, and the play that I'm going to read from today called Streamers. Now, I'm just going to read two short scenes from that play, and it's boys in basic training, and I will say boys in basic training talking about the what-ifs, the unknown, much as I felt 20 years ago. We meet Roger and Billy. Roger's a black soldier and Billy's a white soldier from Wisconsin, a very Midwestern boy like I was. And Billy begins talking. "Man, that's the real damn army over there, ain't it? That ain't shining your belt buckle and standing tall. And we might end up in it, man." Silence. Roger, rising, begins to sort his laundry. "Roger, you ever ask yourself you'd rather fight in a war where it was freezing cold or one where there was awful snakes? You ever ask that question?" "Can't say I ever did." "We used to ask it all the time. All the time. I mean, us kids sitting out in the back porch telling ghost stories at night. Because it was Korea time and the newspapers were full of pictures of soldiers in snow with white frozen beards. They got these rags tied around their feet. And snakes. We hated snakes. Hated them. I mean, it's bad enough to be in the jungle ducking bullets. But then you crawl right into a goddamn snake. That's awful. That's awful." "It don't sound none too good." "I got my draft notice. Goddamn Vietnam didn't even exist. I mean, it existed, but not as a war we might be in. I started crawling around the floor at this house where I was staying, because I dropped out of school, and I was going bang, bang, pretending. My first goddamn formation in basic, Billy. This NCO's up there jamming about how some of us are going to be dying in the war. I'm saying, what war? What that crazy man talking about? Us too. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. And now we got three people going from here. Five." Roger and Billy look at each other and then turn away, each returning to his task. "It don't seem possible. I mean, people shooting at you to kill you. It's something. What did you decide you preferred, huh? Did you decide you would prefer the snakes or would you prefer the snow? Because it looked like it's going to be the snakes." And a little later, Billy and Roger are joined by Richie, a sophisticated New York city soldier, all still a recruit. The war, the threat of it, is the one thing they share in common. And Richie begins speaking. "Richie, I was reading they're planning to build it all up to more than 500,000 men over there. Americans. And they're going to keep it that way until they win." Billy says, "Be a great place to come back from, man, you know? I keep thinking about that. To have gone there, to have been there, to have seen it and lived." Roger, settling onto Billy's bunk, he lights a cigarette. "Well, what we got right here is a fool. Gonna probably be one of them 500,000, too. Do you know I cry at the goddamn anthem yet sometimes? The flag is flying at a ball game. The old Roger gets all wet in the eye. After all the shit been done to his black ass. But I don't know what I think about this war. I do not know. Billy. I'm telling you, Raj, I've been doing a lot of reading, and I think it's right we go. I mean, it's just like when North Korea invaded South Korea, or when Hitler invaded Poland and all those other countries. He just kept testing everybody. When nobody said no to him, he got so committed he couldn't back out, even if he wanted to. And that's what this Ho Chi Minh is doing, and all those other communists. If we let them know somebody's going to stand up against them, they'll back off, just like Hitler would have. Roger. There's folks, you know, who are saying LBJ is Hitler and not old Ho Chi Minh at all. Richie talking as if this is the best news he's heard in years. Well, I don't know anything at all about all that, but I'm certain I don't want to go. Whatever is going on. I mean, those Viet Cong don't just shoot you and blow you up, you know. My God, they've got these other awful things they do, putting elephant shit in all those stakes in the ground, and then when you step on them, you get elephant shit in the wound in your foot. The infection is horrendous. And then there's these caves they hide in, and when you go in after them, they've got these snakes that they've tied by their tails to the ceiling, so it's dark, and the snake is furious from having been hung by its tail, and you crawl right into them. Your face, my God! They do not. I read it, Billy, they do. That's bullshit, Richie. That's right, Richie. They may do that stuff with the elephant shit, but nobody's going to tie a snake by its tail. Let old Billy walk into it. Billy, that's disgusting, man. Roger, guess you better get ready for the Klondike, my man. Billy, that's probably the most disgusting thing I ever heard of. I do not want to go. Not to nowhere where that kind of shit is going on. LBJ is Hitler. Suddenly I see it all very clearly. Roger, Billy got a hatred for snakes. Richie, I hate them too. They're hideous. Billy, I mean, that is one of the most awful things I ever heard of any person doing. I mean, any person who would hang a snake by its tail in the dark of a cave in the hope that some other person might crawl into it and get bitten to death, that first person is somebody who ought to be shot. And I hope the 500,000 other guys that get sent over there kill them all them gooks, get them all driven back into Germany where they belong. And in the meantime, I'll be holding the northern border against snowmen. Okay, reactions to that piece. The piece was written in about 1970, but is set in about 1965. Any reactions, comments about that, about the attitude of the guys?
Sweet little boys, not knowing nothing, just sitting around talking about what they don't know.
I think in some ways for me, it was the state our whole country was in at that time. We didn't really know. Most of us, I remember when I started Augsburg, Vietnam, I think I read about it in Life magazine. My earliest remembrance is reading an article about the Viet Minh in high school, which were supposedly against the French or something vaguely, and there were some pictures in Life magazine. That's all I really knew about it. And then slowly, during the time that I was in college, from 1964 to 1968, of course, was the major escalation. Any other reactions, comments? Okay. Now, as you can tell, the attitude there is still fairly light, and as is this next piece, which is a satirical piece written by a Vietnam vet, Amlin Gray. The name of the play is How I Got That Story. And it was written in about 1975, and it's done only with two actors who play all the parts. And what I'm going to do is just read a little bit from the beginning of the play, which sort of indicates another aspect to the Vietnam War, which is unique, and that is the reporter's view of the Vietnam War. And the character, the actor's name, and the character is called the historical event, and it's a reporter. And lights come up on the reporter. He is wearing a rumpled lightweight jacket with ink stains around the pocket. He holds a somewhat crushed felt hat in one hand and speaks to the audience. Hello there. This is Amboland, my new job with the Transpan Global Wire Service brought me here. It's not the safest place right now, but this is how I figured. The last 2 years, I've been reporting on the western part of East Dubuque. A lot goes on there. If you add it all up right, then you've got western East Dubuque. That's fine. But if you add up Amboland, it's every place. It's it. It's what the world is like. If I just keep my eyes wide open, I can understand the whole world. That's how I figure it. These are the Amboland offices of the Transpan Global. Good-sized outfit, huh? I'm here to pick up my accreditation card so I can work in country. Spell that word without a hyphen. The voice comes on. Next! The reporter walks over to a desk. The deputy coordinator is sitting behind the desk. Coordinator. Hey, may I help you? I'm here to see Mr. Kingsley. May I ask your business? I'm just picking up my card so I can work in country. You'll see Mr. Kingsley. Thank you. Straight back, third door to the right, first left, end down the hall. Thanks. He's expecting you.
He is?
Yes. How? You said you work for Transplant Global.
Yes.
I'm sure you know, then, that our business is communication.
Oh, thank you very much.
The reporter moves off and into the maze of coordinator's direction. When he gets to Kingsley's office, Kingsley is waiting for him. Kingsley stands up from his desk and shakes the reporter's hand. I'm so happy to meet you. Please sit down. He indicates the chair in front of the desk. Don't mind if I stare. It's one of the little pleasures of my job when a byline changes to a face. You look quite like your byline, I must say. I couldn't be more pleased.
Well, thank you.
I admire your work. Before I'd read 2 pages of the samples that you sent us, I said, Bob, please call me Bob. That's what I call myself.
Okay, Bob.
I said, Bob, this is the man for Transplant Global, an impartial man. He views all sides and he writes the truth as he believes it.
If I may, sir, Bob.
Bob, I'm not sure I'd put it quite that way. I don't see... Think belief is too much help to a reporter. What I try to do is see, then write the truth, Bob, as I see it.
My mistake. Poor choice of words. My meaning was, you don't allow some pietistic preconception to subvert your objectivity. You write what you see.
That's very nicely said, Bob. I'll subscribe to that.
On the other hand, you don't write everything you see.
I'm not quite sure I...
If your wife farts in church, you don't run it on the human interest page.
I'm not married.
No, I know you're not. That was a figure of speech.
Okay.
To bring this down to cases, the government of Madam Ng is fighting for its life. You probably know that the guerrillas don't confine themselves to Robert's Rules of Order. Madam Ng is forced in kind to bite and scratch a little. You may see a few examples. Some abridgment of the freedom of internal opposition. Some abridgment of the outer limbs of those involved. These things may rock you. Nothing wrong with that as long as you keep one thing firmly in mind. When we send out reports, the nearest terminal for them is the Imperial Palace. Madam Ng eats ticker tape like eel is fish in fish sauce. That's the A1 delicacy here. You'll have to try it. Can you handle chopsticks?
Yes, I am.
Madam Ng is very sensitive to how she's viewed from overseas. Let's face it. When we applied for permission to set up an agency here, we didn't apply to the guerrillas. It's Ng who allowed us to come here, and it's Ng who has the power to send us back. Let's have a signature.
What's this?
Your press card.
Oh.
You'll find this plastic proof against the rainy season jungle rot. I took a card like this intact right off the body of a newsman who had all but decomposed.
What happened to him?
Madam Ng expelled him, but he didn't leave. The will of a developing government will find a way. We're very glad you're with us.
Kingsley disappears as the reporter, somewhat overloaded, retraces his step through the mazes of corridors and out through the streets. His journey is accompanied by... sounds. And then he finds himself outside.
That was odd. A sudden breeze, now nothing.
He wets his finger and holds it up.
Oriental weather.
Starts walking again. I've heard that the gorillas move so fast you feel a wind and then don't see anything, but sitting in your pocket is a bomb. A moment's delay, then frantically he pats his pockets from chest down, gives a sigh of relief, then registering something, returns to the first pocket that he checked. Slowly he draws out a neatly folded sheet of rice paper. Carefully he opens it. It contains a single wooden match. He reads the message on the paper. Hanshu Street and Perfume Boulevard in 20 minutes. A man will ask you for a light. He checks his watch. 20 minutes, that would be at 2 o'clock. What time is it now? 2:20.
Excuse me, sir.
A man in a conical reed hat has walked on.
Sir, Hansho Street and Perfume Boulevard, which way?
The Ambonese pedestrian snatches the reporter's hat off his head and runs.
Hey, hey!
A chase ensues, with the man appearing from unexpected places and vanishing, the reporter farther and farther behind him. A continuation of the street sounds accompanies the chase.
Hey, come back here! Come back here! Stop! I need that!
Finally, the man strolls on with his reed hat in his hand and the reporter's on his head. Puffing, the reporter comes in sight.
Sir, it's not the hat I want. I won't begrudge you that. I know you probably live in very straitened circumstances. I just want the press card.
The man points at an offstage sign.
Oh,
Hancho Street and Perfume Boulevard. The man holds up his own hat bottom up. The reporter puts money in it. The man takes reporter's hat from his head and flips it to its owner. Then the man ambles off counting his money. I made it. No one here, though. He takes the match out of his pocket and holds it awkwardly in front of him. After a moment, I'll take the opportunity to observe a little atmosphere, writing in a spiral notebook. Busy intersection, people, Hondas, over there a big pagoda. Lot of Buddhists in the window dressed in saffron robes. As he goes on, the bonzi in saffron robe comes on, unseen by him. The bonzi is carrying a large red gasoline can. All ages, every window filled with faces, they're all looking over here in my direction. Not at me, though I don't think at me. The bonzi has poured a pool of gasoline on the pavement. I can smell their incense. The bonzi has set the can down, come up behind the reporter. The reporter spins around. Oh, you startled me. Pause. The bonzi just stands there. Are you my contact? Pause. You're supposed to ask me something. The bonzi stands. The reporter starts to hold the match up again to give the man a hint. The bonzi takes it. That's not incense. That's gas. In one resolute movement, the bonzi walks back to the puddle of gas and sits down cross-legged in the middle of it. He empties the rest of the can over his head. Bonzi, down with Madam Ng, down with the repressive government of Amboland. He scrapes the match on the pavement and at once is burning, a red special effect. The reporter stands rooted with horror. Oh my God, he's burning. People up and down the street are watching. I am too, I'm watching. Quickly, I'm not watching. I'm not here. I'm a reporter. I'm recording this. The monk was sitting in the center of a column of fire. From time to time, a light wind blew the flames away from his face. His face was twisted with the pain. The pain? My God. No, you're not here. You're just recording this. You look at it, you take the pencil, and you write it down. My God, the bonzi topples sideways. He forces his pencil to his pad and writes. Tape fades up, a low repeating chant in Asian-sounding language. Charred black, black circle on the pavement, wisps of orange fabric drifted down the street. Reactions to that piece, which again has one of the functions, I think, of a lot of the Vietnam literature is that it goes from the extremes. It goes from very light kind of feelings to something that becomes horrible. And for me, anyway, and I don't know, maybe for you, that image of the burning monks are one of those images that are frozen from the Vietnam War. Yeah.
Yeah, that was my feeling about that, is that to me was much closer to what my experience back here was. Mm-hmm. Is the satire, the political edge to it, and then that image, as opposed to the first one, which I would think you would have experienced.
Right.
But it didn't sound political enough to me.
Right.
Because what Vietnam became was all of that.
Right.
Edge.
I was thinking that the reporter seemed a little naive at first. He more or less came on the scene thinking that everything was going to be safe as a reporter, and he could view everything from afar and not really get involved.
Have we found that again just recently in China? You know, everybody, Dan Rather, standing on the streets of in Tiananmen Square. It happens. I think. Again, no matter how you feel about the media, they were part of it. And I think for the first time in Vietnam, the media became even more so, primarily through television, because of the images. But it was this recording, you know. Why do we have all these pictures, and we have throughout all wars, I guess, but since photographies and later now television, we have the pictures of the horror. We see that. I mean, nobody's... nobody's stopping, nobody's interfering. It's like this guy, the debate. I'm a reporter, so I keep distance from it, and I watch what happens. I was amazed by photographers that a group of life photographers traveled with my unit in Vietnam, and these guys would stand up in the middle of firefights. All of us soldiers were getting as close to the ground as we possibly could, and these stars were standing up and just clicking away. This book is in the library here, and if you want to look at it, it's called The Vietnam Photo Book, and the reason I pulled it out is because it was one of the early ones, 1971, that this was published and printed, and it was from a soldier reporter who was over there, and that's his ID card, 1969, same time I was. And if you want to check that out sometime, look at it. It's kind of interesting. Any other reactions to this scene?
I was noting that.
Napalm, napalm, I'm God, I'm God, I'm God. Viet Cong center stage. As inconspicuous as possible, camouflage same color as the stage. Last fighter exits, music, bomb fall, impact. Viet Cong leaps and somersaults. Camouflage poncho turns inside out and fire red. Napalm dance. Music screams, dies, bow and exit. Spotlight, man in pulpit. Outside the acting area. Costume, business suit. American flag to his right. Fellow Americans, taxpayers all, we have an announcement of special importance to you tonight. As you know, Vietnam costs us Americans $4 million a day. Has anyone here refused to pay his taxes? No, a record we can all be proud of. Our services are rewarded. Here tonight, in the flesh, direct from Vietnam, is a Viet Cong. Music, two Marines lead in the Viet Cong. They persuade him to kneel. That raggedy little bastard in black pajamas, he shot an American Marine. Music. Fellow citizens, a rare privilege has been bestowed upon us. Marine bows. Unsheaths 45, hands it butt first to a gentleman in the first row, far right. Actors, costume, business suit. Drums, execution type music. We can all do the honors. We can all take part. Everybody hold hands. All together? Good. Count. Three and fire. One, two, three, fire! Red gore explodes. Musicians play Star Spangled Banner. Now, is that more the kind of... it was what theater was trying to do. Do to awake people. I believe theater has a power that very few of the other arts have, and that is directly involving us as human beings in all aspects, intellectually, emotionally, physically, visually, and it surrounds us rather than submerging us. Reactions to...
I was very young, but just when you're reading that, I seems like that's the kind of thing that needs to already start now in relation to the Central American issues. I mean, but nobody ever talks about it now. I mean, it just seems like it's gonna, if the same thing happens, the same sort of confrontation and drama and art is gonna have to go through the, I mean, I just have visions of something like that occurring with Central America.
There's some being done. There's some plays that are being done. One of the best things that's coming out of current theater is there's a strong emphasis on Chicano writers and also Central American writers. I mean, and involving Indian, Central American Indian myths and legends with things that are happening in contemporary ways. Another way is to use plays that have been written in the past to emphasize current attitudes. Same thing happened during Vietnam. A lot of a lot of plays were set in a Vietnam kind of setting or country, to emphasize that. Good point. Anybody else? Any reactions?
Yeah. I'm also probably your age, and my experience of Vietnam is a lot from books or Time Life or footage, mm-hmm. and it often gives me this impression of the news footage, that this is the way it was, and, you know, there's nothing I can do, or there's no way of interpreting it, this is just the way it was. And with the medium of a play, it brings it into a personal, it brings it into a whole different light for me. And just in hearing you read that, you know, how obscene that execution of the Viet Cong was, and how impersonal, how personal you made the impersonalness of the world war when you had the people saying, I'm God, and being the fighter pilots and stuff like that. A very different perspective than seeing footage that's a newsreel, that is just, that's the way it is. Here we've gone and reenacted it, and it's obscene. It's kind of different, very different.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, I'm a contemporary of yours, and what I was struck by is being transported back to that time. I mean, and struck by how different it is in the 80s. I mean, that my whole body just feels that. I mean, I'm realizing that those years were just a tense time.
Yeah.
You were just kind of feeling that yeah. tension all around you, and it's so different now.
Yeah, I was telling someone just a couple of days ago. Several years ago, I got into a discussion with some of my students and ended up leaving the room in tears because of the it was 1984, the middle of the 80s, and of course that year was especially frustrating, but I remember just getting in, and the discussion was happening at the end of October too, so you can imagine. But there was just an obliviousness. But this particular group of students about feeling caring, mm-hmm. world concern, and I was going, what happened? Where did it go? Did I step out of life or something? But and thankfully, the good thing now that I'm seeing is that college students today, I think, are getting much more concerned, much more involved, and I hope that continues.
Yeah, my frustration comes out of realizing that there are so many people that were alive and aware of what was going on, not only with the Vietnam conflict, but with Korea and with, you know, all this other stuff. And I mean, I've never even been a part of that tension and how oblivious we continue to be as conflict after conflict still goes on. I mean, that it's really, I know that it's probably really painful, but I'm overwhelmed.
Could it be overload that we've gotten because of, in the 60s and 70s we had the Vietnam War, and then we had the civil rights movements, the assassinations of presidents, all, you know, and Martin Luther King. All those things just seem to come one right after another in rapid succession.
I think that's what happened at the end of the war, and the country collectively said, this has been too, I mean, it's sort of, I figure it was when Watergate happened. After Watergate, everybody said, come on, let's stop this stuff and let's not talk about it anymore. And as a result, for 10 years at least, most of that was just, let's just sit back and make a lot of money and feel good about ourselves, and, you know, I'm okay, you're okay.
But I think there's still a great, sizable part of our population that believes whatever the president says is right. And patriotism above all else, right or wrong, you're patriotic and you follow what the president says. You know,
and don't burn a flag.
When we go home, when my mother was alive, she died 5 years ago, there were certain things that we just didn't talk about when the family got back together again. Well, she hasn't been around for 5 years. And we finally got back together for a family reunion about 3 weeks ago. And we're sort of on the other side of the fence. And my brother is an old Air Force person, still retired Air National Guard, or Air Force Reserve. And we got just basically a foot in the door, and everybody else in the family says, "Nope, nope, we're not going to talk about this. We're not going to talk about this." I mean, it was mother's voice right there. You know, you don't talk about the other side. You just believe what you've been told.
Still is this. I was telling some people, the reason I went to Vietnam, and the reason I fought in Vietnam, which makes me a coward of my own beliefs, is because I wasn't willing to alienate my family to that extent. If I had gone to Canada, as a lot of our contemporaries from Augsburg did, or became conscientious objectors and worked in social agencies, or gone to prison, that just family-wise would have been, and there's still that. I came back from Vietnam, and everybody wanted me to, you know, be this hero type person, and I was saying, no, you don't understand. It's really, and now I've got documented proof that it's really bad, and nobody wanted to talk about it. It's just fine, you know. Get on with your life. Yeah. Oh yeah. Mike, he was in Vietnam for a year. He's teaching or going to school or something now. But it happens. It happens. The frustrating thing about this is the clock beating. I'm gonna shift a little bit. We're now post Vietnam, and I wanted to do this play because one of the sad things about the Vietnam War, and there have been a couple of plays that have dealt with it, but as most things in our society, many things weren't dealt with, is the black experience in Vietnam and what happened to the blacks in Vietnam. We talk about cannon fodder, and there were certain people in the military that were sacrificed in Vietnam. Americans that were sacrificed in Vietnam. When I was in basic training, I tried, you get to choose what you want to be in, right? For those options. I was in theater, and I was a college graduate and had taught high school for a year, so I figured, oh, I'll get into special services, you know, entertainment, and put together shows for the troops. Or then I heard that was really tough to get into, so I thought, well, I'll sign up to be a medic, you know, because that way I don't have to shoot or anything. And I ended up in the infantry, and I had a friend who knew a friend who worked in the office, and they said, you know, if you've got a college education, if you're a college student at that time in 1969, and they draft a lot of college students, they automatically put them in the infantry. In my advanced infantry training, my advanced individual training group, there were 4 PhDs, 20 MAs, and practically all the rest of us had a BA or a BS. Of that, 2/3 of us were sent to Vietnam. I don't know how many survived, but we could pass any army test with flying colors. But it was those kind of facts are not really well documented. No.
I would say the same thing in my experiences too. It's the first time I've ever heard anybody say that. Yeah.
Are you saying it's as if they wanted to kill you off? Sure. I mean, is that the bottom line?
Well, we had a drill sergeant who was so incensed at us that he basically said that to our face.
There's tremendous anti-student attitudes.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It was just. They figured if you went to college, they weren't number one. Their justification was, they knew you weren't going to stay in the Army, so why waste training on you? So, cannon fodder is the word. I'm going to share this reading. I'm sorry to cut the discussion, but this is a play called Medal of Honor Rag by Tom Cole, and it is about the black experience in Vietnam. And it starts, the play is basically a session, a one-hour session, between a psychiatrist and a black Medal of Honor winner who's had a lot of trouble in his life. And the doctor starts out by reading from this guy's folder. Here's an interesting story. A case study I've been working on, trying to write it out for myself about a certain man who was an unusual type for the world he came from. Rather gentle and decent in manner, almost always easygoing and humorous. Noted for that. As a kid in a tough neighborhood, he had been trained by his mother to survive by combining the virtues of a Christian and a sprinter. He turned the other cheek and ran faster than anyone else. This man was sent by his country to fight in a war unlike any war he might have imagined. Brutal, without glory, without meaning, without good wishes for those who were sent to fight, and without gratitude for those who returned. He was trained to kill people of another world in their own homes in order to help them. How this would help them, we do not really know. He was assigned to a tank and grew closer with the others in the crew, as men always do in war. He and his friends in the tank were relatively fortunate. For almost a year, they lived through insufferable heat, insects, boredom, but were never drawn into heavy combat. Then one night, he was given orders assigning him to a different tank. For what reason? And the black character speaks. His name is DJ. There was no reason. There was no reason. It was the army. It was the army. The next day, his platoon of four M48 tanks were driving along a road toward a place called Dak To, which meant nothing to him. Suddenly, they were ambushed, first by enemy rockets, which destroyed two of the tanks. Then enemy soldiers came out of the woods to attack the two tanks still in commission. This man we were speaking of was in one of those tanks, but the tank with his old friends, the tank he would have been in, should have been in. The tank he might have been in, that tank was on fire. It was about 60 feet away, and the crew he had spent 11 months and 22 days with in Vietnam was trapped inside. DJ looks away in pain. He hoisted himself out and ran to the other tank. Speaking of standing up in a firefight, why he wasn't hit by the heavy crossfire, we'll never know. He pulled out the first man he came to in the turret. The body was blackened, charred, but still alive. That was one of his friends. He kept making a noise to me over and over again, just kept making that same noise, but I couldn't find where his mouth was. Then the tank's artillery shells exploded, killing everyone left inside. He saw the bodies of his other friends all burned and blasted, and then, for 32 minutes, armed first with a 45 caliber pistol and then with a submachine gun, he hunted the Vietnamese on the ground, killing from 10 to 20 enemy soldiers, no one knows for sure, by himself. When he ran out of ammunition, he killed one with the stock of his submachine gun. He kept making the same noise to me over and over. When it was all over, it took three men and three shots of morphine to quiet him down. He was raving. He tried to kill the prisoners they had rounded up. They took him away to a hospital in Pleiku in a straitjacket. 24 hours later, he was released from that hospital, and within 48 hours, he was home again in Detroit with a medical discharge. My mother didn't even know I was coming. A little later in the scene. Tell me when you actually got the medal. You're making me nervous. As my grandmother used to say, that should be the worst thing that ever happens to you. That's the grandmother, could have been a trolley car, if she had wheels. If she had wheels, right. Tell me when you actually got the medal. I've been home 8 months, 9 months, then I get this call. They say it's some army office. They want to know if I'm clean, if I had any rest since I've been back, you know. I tell them I'm clean and just leave me alone. Then two MPs come to the door in uniform, scare the shit out of my mama. They tell just her they want to find out a few things about me, whether I've been a good boy, whether I've been taking any drug. She makes me roll up my sleeves right there to show. No track, see? When they leave, she's sure I've done something terrible, and I shouldn't be afraid to tell her that she'll forgive me anything. And all I can do is sit there in the kitchen and laugh at her, which makes her mad, and even more sure that I'd done something weird. Well, about 15 minutes later, a colonel calls up from the Department of Defense in Washington, tells me they're going to give me the Congressional Medal of Honor, and could I come down to Washington right away with my family, as President Lyndon B. Johnson himself wants to hang it around my neck with his own hands. He'll pay for the ticket, he said. So another ride on a jet plane. A goddamn honor guard meets us at the airport. Beatrice is peeing in her pants. My mother's with me, my cousin William. They got a dress blue uniform waiting for me, just my side. Shoes, socks, everything. Escort, sirens. Yesterday afternoon, all I knew, I was a junkie on the streets. Today, the President of the United States can't wait to see me. ain't this a lot of shit? You wept. I don't know, I kind of cracked up. The flashbulbs were popping in my eyes. My mother's hugging me, she said, saying, honey, what are you crying about? You made it back. It was weird. Weird, man. Why was it weird? I don't know. You do know. What are you driving at? What did you get that medal for? For your good manners and gentle ways? I got that medal because I went totally out of my fucking skull and killed everything across my sight. They say I wanted to kill all the prisoners. Me. You don't remember? Nothing. A few flashes, maybe. Those people are all so small. So your mother was hugging you in the White House for doing what she had trained you all your life not to do, for being a killer. And everybody was celebrating you for that. And your dead friends from the tank, who you had tried so hard to bury, came back to you to haunt you. You had to relive that story, that flash of combat when a man's life is changed forever, when he literally goes crazy, psychotic, in a world of no past and no future, compacted into a few seconds, a wild pounding of the heart, blinding light, explosions, terror, and his whole earlier life slides away from him through a membrane as if he lost forever, and all he can do is kill. All that was named, broadcast, printed on a banner, and waved in your face so you can never forget. And you wonder why you wept, why you were confused, why you were here in this hospital? You wept for your dead friends. You wept for your dead self, for your whole life that slid away in the first 15 seconds of that ambush on the road to Dakto. You were choking on your grief, a grief you couldn't share with anyone, and you became paralyzed by your guilt. And you still are, and you're going to be, until you decide to make your own journey back through that membrane into some acceptable reality, some real life of your own. I don't know how to do that, Doc. I will tell you. Do you intend to stay in this hospital for a while? Why do you ask? Maalox and Bland diet prescribed, GI series conducted, results negative. Subject giving 30-day convalescent leave, 16 October 1970. Absent without leave until 12 January 1971, when subject returned to hospital on own volition. Subsequent hearing recommended dismissal of AWOL charges and back pay reinstated in cognizance of subject's outstanding record in Vietnam. Well, yeah, they can't do anything to me. Because of the medal? Because of the medal. And then he goes away. The discussion continues. And the doctor says, DJ, do you watch TV here? Some. The news? Not if I can help it. You didn't see it the other night. What? The medals. Vietnam vets. Heroes? In wheelchairs, some of them. On crutches. At the Capitol steps. Washington? Throwing their medals away? A kind of miracle scene like the... That's not what you want. That's what you want me to do? Hop right down there and toss it up? You saw it? I didn't see nothing. Some of those men, I happen to know some of those men. You cured them? They're curing themselves, and they're a lot like you. But they refuse to stay isolated. They meet in therapy groups, which they started up in New York. Rap sessions, a new kind of unit, you might say. Everybody tells a story, you see? They're people who have been through the same fires you had, who were there, whom you can trust. Doc, those dudes on TV are all white. You have been watching them. Yep, and I'm going to tell you something. You got your reasons for wanting me to see no more war, right? And no more warriors? I dig that, for your sake. But a lot of folks don't want the black veteran to throw down his weapon so soon. Know what I mean? Like we are supposed to be preparing ourselves for another war right back here. Vietnam was just our basic training, see? I'm telling this to both of you, you see, so you won't be too surprised when it comes. Why are you saying this right now? I want you to have something to think about for the next session. Give us a good starting point. Still poking fun of me? Don't worry, Doc. I'll be seeing you. You just sit down and write your notes in the folder. The doctor speaks. When I drove down again from New York 2 days later, Dale Jackson did not appear for his hour of therapy. He was, in fact, AWOL back in Detroit. He intended to do something about his money troubles. His wife was in a hospital for minor surgery, and he had been unable to pay the deposit. There were numerous protectors he might have gone to in the city for help, people who would not have allowed a Medal of Honor winner to sink into the scandalous debt. But he went to none of them this time. His wife was disturbed about the bill. This was on the evening of April 30th. He promised her that he would come back to the hospital that night with a check, and also with her hair curlers and bathrobe. As he was leaving, he said, "Ain't you gonna give me a kiss goodbye?" And he put his thumb in his mouth like a little boy, which made her laugh. He asked some friends to drive him to a place where he claimed he could get some money, asked them to park in a white section of town. He walked down the block, entered a grocery store, and told the manager he was holding it up. He took out a pistol, but never fired a shot, while the manager emptied his own gun at point-blank range into DJ's body. Death came a few hours later in Detroit General Hospital of 5 gunshot wounds. His body went on a last unexpected jet airplane ride to Arlington National Cemetery, where he was given a hero's burial with an 8-man Army honor guard. I wrote to his mother about him, about what a remarkable human being even I could see he was in only 60 minutes with him. She wrote back, "Sometimes I wonder if Dale tired of this life and needed someone else to pull the trigger." In her living room, she keeps a large color photograph of him in uniform with the Congressional Medal of Honor around his neck. This experience was not my experience. I was lucky in many ways. This play, by the way, is based on a real incident that did happen. A black Medal of Honor winner was shot in Detroit trying to hold up a liquor store. And even though the play is fictional, I think it points up one of the other results of that particular conflict, which still exists today. In 1981, 34% of all prisoners in Stillwater Prison in Minnesota were Vietnam veterans.
34%?
This reaction to society and relation to society was a problem that for many years was not really spoken of. And then television and film got caught up in it, of course, and then I used to introduce myself by saying, "I'm a Vietnam veteran, don't worry, I'm not going to freak out before you and start killing people." Because that's the image that was presented in the 70s of the Vietnam veteran. Reinforced. Then we went through a revisionism, which happened in the 80s. And for a while, in the early 80s, it was Rambo as our major image, and Chuck Norris missing in action. Let's go back and win it this time. And one soldier can take on thousands of those little slant-eyed gook people because they're not real human beings. The myth that somebody was talking about enemies and dehumanizing people, which is what the Army did. The myth when I was in Vietnam was people would go, "You know, they don't even bleed. Did you know that? They don't bleed. Pick them up. They're like wax dummies. They don't bleed. They're not real." And a lot of young men, 17, 18 years old, bought into that and then suddenly got back and said, "Wait a minute. Those were real people and I killed them. Now, what do I do here?" I think we're over time, which is unfortunate because the one scene that I wanted to read was a very important play, and I recommend you reading it. It's a play by Emily Mann, and it's called Still Life. And the characters in the play are two women and a Vietnam veteran, the wife of the veteran and the veteran's girlfriend. And it's a very powerful, moving play that's done based upon recordings that Emily made. I went to graduate school with Emily Mann at the University of Minnesota, and we had a discussion one night, and I don't take any claim to this play, but we were talking about my Vietnam experience, and she became involved with an artist who was a Vietnam veteran and taped long conversations with he and his wife and another woman and these that was involved with that, and these tapes became the basis of the play. And the play is done in an interesting way because all three characters are on stage speaking to the audience. They're sitting behind a table, and the veteran is showing slides, and they don't talk to each other, but they talk to the audience. And it's done in three acts, but the three acts happen simultaneously with each of the people talking individually. And had I more time, I would...
Oh, yeah, you have time.
If anybody has to leave, I would please do. Again, thank you for coming. If you're rolling the tape, you can cut it at this point if you want. But I, for anybody that would like to stay for a few minutes, I'll continue reading that last.
I wish I could stay. Okay. I have to go.
Okay. Thank you. As I said, the name of the play is Still Life. And there are three characters, so I'll mention the characters' names as I talk. Mark begins speaking, and he snaps on a picture of his wife, Cheryl, young, fragile, thin, hair flowing, quintessently innocent. This is a picture of my wife before lights come up on Cheryl. She's 6 months pregnant.